there's anyone here now that can't hear me, I want you to hold up your hand. I want to be sure everybody suffers as much as I do through this. I'm very grateful tonight. I'm grateful that by the grace of God and the help of you people that I'm living tonight. Because I am certain that without that help, that I would no longer be living tonight. And I'm very grateful to the Augusta Group for asking me to share this convention with you. For those of you who don't know me, my name is Pelham Green. And it's beginning to sound just a little bit ridiculous, my getting up here and saying I'm an alcoholic. Back when I was drinking, everybody who didn't see me, I called them up. Several years back, I was asked to come to a city to talk, and they told me they met at the Episcopal Church. And I didn't know where the church was, so I stopped and asked a lady where the Episcopal Church was. And as I started off, she turned around and said, "They meet around at the back." So there's no use in my telling you I'm an alcoholic. Somewhere early in our life, we must form a philosophy of life. And on the success of that philosophy, it must contain three things: faith, hope, and charity. Without those three things, we sink into an abyss of degradation and despair from which few return and many don't. I know, because I am one of that number. I am not a psychiatrist. I can't tell you why you drank whiskey. I don't know why I drank myself. So I don't try to go into that part of it. I only have a story to tell you. A story of what happened to me before AA and since AA. And what I tell you is only a small part of the 20 years that I stayed drunk, because most of it I don't remember. It's gone beyond recall. Now, I was born and reared in a small town in North Alabama. My family were pioneers of the town and county. A family of doctors on both sides of the family. And I know now, as I look back, that every one of them was alcoholics. Except back in those days, they called them drunks. I can remember why, when I was only a small child, that when my mother heard that one of my uncles was coming to spend the night, she hid all of the bay rum and the pea rooney and the vanilla extract. And that was back in the days before people had become enlightened enough to know that all that was good to drink. So I grew up with an abhorrence of anything to do with alcohol. And I fairly hated people who drank. And had somebody have told me that someday that I myself would have been an alcoholic, I would have thought they were crazy. I think my childhood was as most normal children, except that I lost my mother at the age of 9. And my resentment started. I resented the fact that my mother died and other people's mothers lived. And I grew up with a sense of not belonging. And the people whom I would have normally associated with, I didn't like. And I still don't like them much. And the ones I did associate with, I know now that they only did it because I had money. So I didn't belong there. I went to high school at the age of 10. And most of the other students were in their late teens and some in their early 20s. So again, I didn't have a sense of belonging. So I left home with a carnival. After 2 years, my father found me and brought me back home, running a very promising career. I had worked up the talker in the Hawaiian show. But I came back and finished high school. Now, I drank whiskey twice in high school. And both times I got in trouble. And that has been the story of my life. Every time I drank, I got in trouble. I never got in jail just for being drunk. It's always drunk and something or other. But the first time was after a football game one afternoon. One of the boys whose father was county commissioner had drove a county truck to town, and he brought a half a gallon of white whiskey. After the game, we drank that whiskey, and he also had a case of dynamite in the truck. So I took the dynamite and blew up the outdoor toilet with it. And the principal told me they could do without me for the rest of that year. The next time I drank any whiskey, I happened to be passing the jail on Saturday night, and it was full of drunks. And as I knew where the key was and felt sorry for them, I turned them all out. And only the fact that my father was mayor at the time kept me from being in serious trouble. And I think that must have frightened me a little. Because I went on to college and I didn't drink any in college. But I came out of college in 1930, in the midst of a depression. I came home and married a childhood sweetheart and went to work for an automobile concern. Back in 28 and 29, they had had 5 alcoholic salesmen working there. And they had sold every bootlegger and every moonshiner on Sand Mountain Automobile. And they still owed for it. So it was my job to try to collect that money. Well, now, I didn't collect much money. But I collected a lot of whiskey. And I think that very shortly that I went over the line into compulsive drinking. It wasn't too long till I'd be a couple of days getting back. And then it got to be a week. And then it finally got to where they had to come after me. And it wasn't too long till I was having those visitors that come and go through the wall and sit on the foot of the bed and laugh at you. I got to where they didn't bother me. I knew a lot of them. been dead a long time. Then one day I had an alcoholic convulsion on the street and all. And that frightened me. And I stayed sober a couple of days. I went on to have many more. And I even told my wife that I thought they helped me. That I always felt a lot better after I had one. And I remember after the first one I had that I noticed that nobody got close to me. They handed me things from a distance. And I'd had a puppy at home, and they were waiting to see if that dog went mad before they'd get close to me. They thought maybe I'd been mad dog bit. Now, the man I was working for didn't have any money. He was broke. And he couldn't pay the people working for him, and I wasn't getting paid. So I devised a scheme. I went out to a bootlegger's, and I was going to buy whiskey and sell that whiskey and pay myself. So I went out and got 20 gallons, and I brought it up to a bootlegger just above town and sold it to him for $2 a gallon. And he didn't have the money to pay me. And he told me I'd have to wait and sell it till he sold. During the time he was selling this whiskey, I was going back and forth buying it from him at 50 cents a pint. When we went to settle up, I owed him $8. That was my only experience bootlegging. Now, my wife was always a very unreasonable woman. And she had begun to wonder why I wasn't getting home any oftener than I was. And she got to question me. She got to meddling in my business. And if there's anything on earth that makes an alcoholic mad, it's to ask him where he's been when he doesn't even know himself. So we were beginning to be very unhappy at home. So I came home one day and I found a note. She said she'd gone home. And if I wanted her, I could come after her. And I loved my wife very much. And I stayed sober one whole day. And I told her that if she'd come back, never again, as long as I live, would I take a drink. That was on Monday. On Tuesday, the man whom I'd been working for in the automobile business was running for judge of probate. And he came to my house and asked me if I would go out on the mountain and get a man and his wife and his sister and bring them to town and vote. And I told him that I would. The man is dead now, and I don't think he ever knew it. But he lost 4 votes that day. We didn't get in until almost a week after the election. And again I found another note. She'd gone again. After studying it over, I decided it'd probably be best to let her stay home. So for the next year, I was drunk all the time. For the next 18 months, I don't think I drew a sober breath. Now, during all this time that I was drunk, there'd been a lot of things happening around my hometown that I didn't know about. They'd build a hotel that I didn't know. You'd have to see my hometown to appreciate that. One Sunday, I had started up to a bootlegger's, and they'd built a church along the road. Had I known it, I would never have passed it. But when they saw me come by, some women came out and got me. And I was too weak to resist, and I went in. So I decided that day maybe that was what I needed, that I needed to get in the church. So I joined the church. And the day they took me into the church, everybody in that county was there. And that made me mad. I resented it very much. And I stayed sober 9 months, the longest period in 20 years. And it wasn't long till I was teaching the Sunday school class. And I wasn't fit to teach the Sunday school class. And then that church made the greatest mistake they ever made in their life. They put me on the board of stewards. And by that time, I was wanting to get drunk. And I was against everything that came up. And I didn't hesitate to get up and say so. I even wanted to cut the minister's salary. And you can know how popular that made me. And when I got drunk and left, they didn't ask me to come back, and they ever have yet. And the only thing that I'm proud of about that 9 months, my father died during that time, thinking that I'd never drink again. When he died, he left me enough that I've taken care of it. I would never have had to worry again. But 2 weeks after his death, I was drunk again. And I stayed drunk a solid year. I got in jail as much as 3 times in one day. I ran an account with the city and paid them up once a month, just like you pay your grocery bill. So finally I came to the conclusion that they were imposing on me and that I would just leave there and never come back again. I made a deed out to my sister for all the property that I had and mailed it to her and left. Well, now, I smoked marijuana down on the border, and I tried opium in the dens of San Francisco. And then I wound up drunk all over Europe. I finally landed back in New York, and I had $10 in my pocket. By that time, I was so full of fear that I was almost afraid to move. I had money at home in the bank. I was afraid to wire for it, afraid they wouldn't send it, and afraid if they did send it, that I couldn't get the check cash. So for the next 9 weeks, I stayed on the Bowery. I made the prop houses and the missions along the Bowery, and I drank smoke in the back alley. Until one day, one of the men who ran a mission stopped me, and he got to question me. And he asked me about myself, and I told him. And that man helped me to get the money to come home on. Some of you may have heard of him. He established a mission along the Bowery, Mel Trotter. Helped me to get home. When I got home, I started right in just like I left. And finally, the man whom I had so much to do with electing Judge of Probate offered me a job. And I stayed there the next 3 years. And I was drunk every day that I worked there. I brought a pint of whiskey to work with me every morning. Until the sheriff got to where every time I'd leave my desk, he would search it to see if I had any whiskey. Till I got smart enough to hide it in his office. At the end of this 3 years, I was beginning to have trouble with the Board of Revenue. Now, they didn't mind my being gone so much except on payday. And if I wasn't there on payday, they got out to hunt me. And they knew right where to look. And I got improper with the bootleg, because they didn't want the sheriff coming. And it got to the place to where the only way I could get whiskey was just stick out my hand, let them hand it to me, and keep going. So that made me mad. So finally in 1940, in order to make the Board of Revenue feel bad, I volunteered for service. And much to my disappointment, they accepted me in the Army Specialist Corps. And the recommendation that the Board of Revenue gave me, Franklin D. Roosevelt would have been proud of. They was going to be sure I didn't come back. Now, I was auditing Army installations, and I had found just exactly what I'd been looking for. I didn't stay anywhere too long at a time, and I managed to get in some kind of reports. I doubt if anybody ever looked at them. And I didn't have any trouble, except when I would go from one place to the other. I would invariably be from 2 to 3 weeks late getting there. And the telephone calls I made explaining why I wasn't there would have gone a long way on winning the war. I remember once I stopped in Atlanta for 30 minutes between trains. And I hired a rolling chair and went down an alley in Atlanta and got some whiskey. And he had a brother. For the next 3 days, they rolled me in Atlanta in that rolling chair. And 20 minutes after every train ran, here we come rushing into the station. Finally, in busy wartime, the station master held a train 15 minutes to get me on it. But he put me on the wrong train. I went up the road about 20 miles and they put me off and then on another train back into Atlanta. When I came through the gates of the station master took off his cap and threw it down on the floor and said, "Hell, I quit." I finally got on up to Oak Ridge, Tennessee, and whiskey then was beginning to catch up with me. I wound up in the hospital, and I don't think honestly that the Army doctors ever knew what was wrong with me. Finally, one of them said, Tom said, "The thing for you to do is to take an indefinite leave of absence and go home to rest." And I did. I lived exactly 3 blocks from the bus station, and it took me 3 weeks to get from the bus station home. I stayed drunk all that summer. And again, I decided the environment was causing me to drink. So I went to Charlotte, North Carolina, where I stayed the next 3 years. Now, I always liked to go to new places and get new jobs. They didn't know you. You could be sick on Monday, and they wouldn't think much about it. And even sometimes you could go on up till Tuesday. But finally, some smart aleck is going to stick his nose in your business, and then you've had it. Finally, my boss told me, he said, Bum, said, I don't want to fire you. When you're here, you do as much work as two people. He said, if you will get here every week by Wednesday morning, I won't open my mouth to you. The very next week, I got in on Thursday. One morning, I was sitting in a cafe trying to drink a cup of coffee with both hands, and a man sitting by me said, what's wrong with you? And I said, I've been sick. And he gave me two capsules. Said, you take this and drink that coffee, and said, you'll feel all right. And I did. And I wondered why somebody hadn't told me about that before. And I bought me 200 of them. For the next month, I got to work every morning. And I didn't have a bit of trouble. Oh, I run into the door a few times. And I missed a chair and sit down on the floor. But I got there. One day I happened to be kind of at myself, and I got to looking at the books, and I couldn't even read them myself. So I had to get drunk again to get off a goofball. Now, I stayed in Charlotte 3 years. Every holiday, every vacation, I'd start home. I couldn't get there. Finally, in 1947, I made up my mind that was one time I was going to get home. And I didn't take a drink till I got on the bus. And I knew when I woke up the next morning by the smell that I was in jail somewhere. I finally got the jailer to the door, and he said, you're in Murphy, North Carolina. You fell off of the bus like that. And I told him, I said, I'm a very sick man. Would you please get the city judge to come down? And he did. And I told the judge that a month before then that I had been in a very serious automobile accident. And that I was trying to get home before I died. And I told him that the doctor had told me if I would take a few drinks along the road, that I might make it. I must have convinced that man, for he sent out and got me a pint of whiskey. And when I left Murphy that night, I was much drunker than I was when I came into Murphy. And I know that man will always wonder why I went back towards Charlotte instead of going home. Christmas of 1947, I had been doing an audit in Richmond, Virginia. And I finished up on the 23rd day of December, and I was going home. On the way back to the hotel, it had been snowing and raining, and it had turned into sleet. A very miserable day. And I happened to pass a whiskey store. And I thought, well, now they'll be expecting me to bring some whiskey home with me. So I went in and I bought 4 quarts of whiskey. Back in the hotel room, packing, looking out that snow and ice, I decided that I ought to have at least one drink of it myself. And I remember taking three drinks. When I woke up the next morning and looked out the window, the sun was shining, the birds were singing, and the palm trees were green. And I thought, well, I'll play the hell this time. I've died. Had I stopped to think, though, there wouldn't have been any birds and palm trees where I'd been. I finally found the telephone and called. They said, you're in Miami, Florida. You came in on the plane last night. I made up my mind then and there that I would never get home again. There was no use in trying. There was no use in working. That I would just give up. I finally got back to Charlotte and didn't call up and tell them that I'd quit or anything about it. For the next 4 months, I stayed drunk all that 4 months. And I was doing enough public accounting to pay for my whiskey. I'd long before quit eating, so that didn't bother me. And I owed the man at the hotel so much, he's afraid if he said anything to me, he never would get. During this 4 months, I woke up one morning in the home of a drunken dentist friend of mine. And I had had a lot of hangovers, but never one like that. And I got to feeling around, and I found out I didn't have any teeth. Finally found his wife and asked her what had happened to him. And she said, last night you complained of a toothache. And said every time you'd pull one, you'd say that was the wrong one. Said you finally had pulled so many that you decided to be better to pull all of them. And I hadn't had a bad tooth. And she said you all were drinking whiskey out of a white fruit jar. And said I couldn't tell if it was blood or water. And I have been sick all night long and vomiting. And I am leaving. And I'm never coming back. And she did, and she hasn't been back. So I had to stay another week drunk while he made me some teeth. And he must have done a very good job. I still have. But shortly after that, the man whom I'd been working for called me up and asked me if I would come out and make out some reports. And I told him I would. And he asked me if I would like to have my job back. And for the first time in my life, I told the truth. I said, I am hopeless. I can't possibly stay sober. There's no reason my taking a job. And he said, well, Paul, he said, I have a brother-in-law who used to be just like you are, and said he went to something down here they call AA, and he's been sober for 5 years. Said, will you go down? And I said, yes, I'll go. And I did go. But I drank a half a pint of whiskey before I went. When I walked into the club room in Charlotte that night, there must have been 100 people there. A lot of them I knew. Some of them were doctors and lawyers, and others I'd seen in the gutter. And they were all happy and having a good time. And I knew immediately they were all drunk. Because I couldn't imagine anybody being happy unless they were. And I enjoyed that meeting. I thoroughly enjoyed it. I even got up and made a talk. The next morning, they didn't know I was drunk. The next morning, one of them called me and said, there's a woman called in from the hotel you're staying in. And said, we can't get up there right now. Said, well, you go around and see her. And I said, I'll be glad to. There I was drunk. I didn't know anything about AA. But I got that girl sober. And I got myself sober. We both got in jail. When my boss came down after me to get me out, I said, the hell were they? I've never had any trouble getting in jail by myself. And I sure don't need any help. So he said, well, I have a very good friend here who is a psychiatrist. He said, will you go down and see him? And I said, yes, I will. So I went down and I questioned the psychiatrist. After about 30 minutes, he came up with an answer. He said, you are a dipsomaniac with a schizophrenic tendency. And you know I was proud of that. I didn't know what in the hell it meant. But I knew anybody that had that much wrong with them had a perfect right to drink. And then he says, why don't you try AA? I said, uh-uh. One more trip and I'd go into the penitentiary. And he said, well, all of your life, said, you have been running from things. Said, the thing for you to do is to go back home. And I said, no. I've been trying for 3 years. And I haven't made it yet. So he called my boss, and together they called a cab from my hometown to come after me. And I didn't know when I got there, but I got home. And this summer I was drunk all summer, except I wasn't drinking whiskey. I was drinking vanilla extract, rubbing alcohol, bay rum, anything with alcohol in. I know I met a minister on the street one day, and he said, Paul, every time I pass you this summer, you invariably smell like a mixture between a baker and a barber shop. Now, there was one difference in this summer. I wasn't getting in jail. And the reason why, I had got smart. I wouldn't walk. I made him carry me. And they had to go up a long flight of steps. And I'd hold all along. So they dodged me. A man told me after I got sober that he was sitting down in the car with them one night, and they saw me coming up the street holding to the wall. So one of them turned around to the other one and said, "Hell, let's get out from here." Said, "Yonder comes Powell. If he gets in here, we can't get him out." I couldn't get in jail, so I finally decided I'd send myself to the insane asylum. So I went up to the courthouse, and the girl came up, and I told her I wanted to get out papers for the insane asylum. And she was very nice. She went and got the papers, brought them back, and said, "Now, who do you want these for?" I said, "Myself." And she disappeared. Now, you're getting in pretty bad shape in your own hometown when you can't even get in jail or they won't have you in the insane asylum. You're just about to the end of the road. But I did manage to get in jail the latter part of the summer. They just had to put me there. And when they tried me, they gave me a 10-day jail sentence. And I remember sitting in the courtroom that day and looking around the wall. They had pictures of all the former mayors of the town there. And my father and my grandfather and two of my uncles were on there. And what I thought that day, I never thought once that I ought to be ashamed. I thought this is one hell of a thing to do to somebody whose people have done as much to this town as mine has. And while I was in this, serving this 10 days, the chief of police came down and told me, he said, "Pelham, they're starting an AA group here tonight. And if you'll go, I'll turn you out of jail." And I said, "No, thank you. I'll just stay in jail." Now, I had managed to keep my home in Fort Payne, a fact of which I boasted very much, that I had none as bad as most people, that I had kept my home. And the reason why I had, my father left it where I couldn't set it. And I never had anything to make me mad in my life to think that he thought that I wouldn't have sense enough to keep my own. Now, I had some people living in there all summer, and they were getting pretty tired of my being drug in and out. One Sunday morning, I got up and went to the bathroom. And the day before, they'd been having a Rexall sale downtown. You buy one bottle of something, and you get another bottle for a penny. Anyhow, I found 4 bottles of Liddy E. Pinkham's compound. And I sincerely hope that the lady never had any urgent need for it, for I drank all 4 of them. That was the straw that broke the camel's back. She moved out the next day. On September the 11th, 1948, I'd been drunk that day on K-Law. I don't know if any of you have ever drank it or not, but it's a very delicious drink. It's made out of soap suds and ethyl alcohol. And the only trouble you have with it is to keep from blowing bubbles when you talk. But shortly after dark that night, it had been raining that day, and I hadn't had enough extra money to have the house covered. They'd cut off my lights and my water, and the rain was dripping through onto the floor. 4 men came into my room, They were all carrying candles. It looked exactly like a wake. And I remember wondering why in the hell they didn't bring two more in a coffin. One of them was a minister of the Methodist Church. He himself was an alcoholic. I didn't know it at that time. And he said, "Palma, I have lost a whole summer fooling with you." He said, "You have built a fence around yourself that nobody can get inside of." And he said, "I am washing my hands of you." And they got up and left. And I remember thinking as they went out, there went the last four friends I had on earth. And I got up, and for the first time in 20 years, I got out on my knees. And I asked God to either let me get sober or let me die. And when I got up from praying, I remembered a book that they gave me at that meeting in Charlotte. A little blue book called A Way of Life. And I had kept it and had it in my trunk. And I believe that God must have had a hand in it somewhere. Because I got that book and I went to read. And for the first time in 20 years, I began to have a little hope. Now those people hadn't left. They came back in and brought a full quart of whiskey. And said, "Tell them you might need a drink." And they set it down on my table. It had been a long time since anybody had offered me a drink. And nobody had turned a whole bottle over to me. Well, I never took a drink out of that bottle. And by the grace of God and the help of you people, I haven't had one yet. Since that time, those four men that came to see me have all died. None of them made the AA program. But nothing will ever make me believe but that when their day of judgment comes, that God won't remember a night that they came to see a man without faith and without hope. I didn't sleep very much that night. I think that most of my thoughts went back to my childhood days. But they were the only happy days that I'd ever known. And I remembered standing by my mother's bed as she was dying. And she turned and said, "Pelham, I'm going to have to leave you. But always put your faith in God and you'll be all right." Well, I had strayed a long, long way from those teachings. But somehow I like to believe that my mother's prayers did follow me down through those days. Then I remembered another day as I walked out of Mayo's clinic one spring morning with a verdict ringing in my ear that I only had 6 months to walk and probably not over 2 years to live. As I came out that morning, I stopped just a moment and I asked God to never let me be a burden on anyone or to bother anybody with my affliction. And I knew that that prayer was answered because I don't think that I ever have. It's never really ever bothered me very much. But never once had I ever thought that you could pray about your drink. Well, I began to go to AA meetings and I stayed sober from September up until Christmas. I wasn't too happy, but I didn't drink. On Christmas of that year, I was in another hotel room. I had spent many miserable, lonely days in a hotel room. And I didn't have to be there this Christmas. But in that afternoon, I knew the reason I was staying in that hotel, that I wanted to feel sorry for myself. And I knew definitely then and there that I had to get something more out of AA than I was getting, or I might as well be drunk. When I came into AA, I admitted that I was an alcoholic. I don't know that I knew what one was, but I knew if it had anything to do with whiskey, I was it. But I stopped with the God business. I didn't like that. I never doubted about what there was a God, but I felt like that he kind of gave me a dirty deal. And I just wasn't having anything to do with it. And then it came down there, that part about insanity. Smart as I was, I certainly wasn't going to admit I'd been insane. And I got to study. And I remembered one time we only had about four calves in my hometown. And my father asked them not to carry me after whiskey. So one morning I called every one of them and nobody came. Finally, in desperation, I called an ambulance. And it backed up to the door. Except back in those days, they really weren't ambulances. They were hearses, just big enough to slide a casket in. And no one who knew what they were doing would have got in that thing. But I got in it and lay down. At that time, the nearest hospital was Gadsden, Alabama. He didn't even ask me where I wanted to go. When he turned over the mountain going into Gadsden, he said, "Which hospital do you want to go to?" I said, "I'm not going to a hospital. Stop at the whiskey store." And it made him mad. But he knew I wouldn't pay him if he didn't. So he stopped and I went in and I came out with a pack sack full of whiskey. And I got back in and lay down. We got up the road a few miles and he came back and opened the doors and said, "You're going to have to move up in the front." And I said, "Why?" He said, "You've been waving at people as we're paid." And you've almost caused two or three wrecks. And he was so mad that he took a drink. And we kept passing the bottle back and forth. And when we got home, I was driving. In the yard with a siren wide open. All the neighbors had been gathered in. They'd been expecting me to be brought home dead a long time. And I know how disappointed they were when I came walking out with that peck sack full of whiskey. My father said that he was so embarrassed that he thought he would sell everything he had and leave there. And I thought it was smart. And I said, "I'll bet they don't stop me from getting a cab again." And they didn't. And then I remembered another occasion. I was going to school at the University of Alabama. And the university ground and the asylum grounds adjoined. And we didn't have automobiles back then like college boys now. And we used to take our dates and walk out through the grounds of Bryce Hospital. They're very beautiful in the spring. And I had a date with a girl from Florida whom I was very much in love with at that time. And we walked out through the grounds. They had let the intimates out. And we were looking at them about like you would a lion in a cage. There was an old lady sitting right inside the fence knitting. And she looked up at me and said, "You better get back in here." If they catch you out there, they'll give you hell. Well, that ruined my whole afternoon. Especially as a girl kept sniggering about nothing. I never had another date with that girl. But I often thought down through the years how right that old lady was. I ought to have been back over in there with her. I have found many, many things in AA. I found a God that I know and understand. And I have thousands of friends that I love from coast to coast. And as a bonus, I've had 16 years that I never expected to have. All of that I owe to you people. That's why I'm here tonight. I'm trying to carry that message. I'm still working on those 12 steps. And I probably will be the day I die. But it's been a happy 16 years. It hasn't all been easy. I've had my ups and downs. But the thing I'm thankful for tonight is that never once during that time did I ever think that a drink of whiskey would help my trouble. I think we all have a cross to bear. With us, it's alcoholism. With others, it may be something else. But I do believe that we can carry that cross on triumphantly. And that we can be better men and better women because of it. And that the world will have been a better place because we've been here. I have found the only thing in AA that money never bought me. A sense of belonging. And the love of my fellow man. When I leave this world, I will leave it with much less than I came into it with. But I'll have the only thing that you can carry with you. And when my time does come to go, I can think of no epitaph that I'd like better than the first verse of an old poem that I've always loved. Sunset clear, an evening star, and one prayer call for me, and may there be no moaning at the bar when I put out to sea, I think.